I need you to knock some sense into me. I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I don't know.
I enjoy listening to you. I don't always agree with everything.
All right. Enough of this persiflage.
So, you want my question?
I'm certainly not going to get myself in trouble by telling you what to do.
That makes great sense. Gosh, that's good.
That I overwhelm you with words and wisdom?
I've got 7 kids. I feel like I could call you every day.
What? Wait, you're telling me I'm wrong?
Yes, I am, Dr. Ray.
You just need to tune in to Dr. Ray, honey. She's got all the answers.
Am I right or am I right?
Probably.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Very, very nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In on this variant of The Doctor Is In E-Person Monday, where I'm looking at my phone here and scrolling down through the emails that have come in. Why don't you just say Email Monday, Ray? It's a lot simpler. Because male is gender specific. I just want to say e-person, including everyone. We do this with an awful lot of our hymns, don't you? Have you noticed that, too? Sometimes we even make God, we take away the maleness of God, even though that's how he chose to communicate with us. He is neither male nor female, that is true, but how he chose to communicate with us. But, nevertheless. Okay, now, we'll get to those momentarily. Go to the computer, type in child, self-esteem, search. Tens and tens of millions of options. Articles, commentaries, everything about self-esteem and children. Type in child humility, search. When I did that, the options were but a small fraction of the self-esteem options. Most experts believe that self-esteem is the acme of virtues, if they would even use that word. It's the acme of well-adjustment. You need to have a very positive self-esteem. Because if you have a positive self-esteem, so goes many of the theories, that you will be less likely to engage in antisocial or self-defeating behavior or drug-related behavior. Self-esteem will be a nice buffer. If you have a positive self-esteem, it'll be a nice buffer for you to do things that would hurt your psychic well-being. That's the theory. Unfortunately, the research has not supported that. Self-esteem is a good thing to have if it's balanced. For Christians, we are fortunate enough to have, I think, the most solid self-esteem. And that is because our self-esteem does not depend upon our declaration. Ray Guarendi is a wonderful human being because Ray Guarendi says so. There's some wobbliness in that. But if I say, I believe I'm infinitely valuable because the God of the universe says so. Now that's real self-esteem. I remember coming across a study, survey once, that said population that has among the highest of consistent self-esteem are men incarcerated. That their self-esteem, their view of themselves, is very high. One might even say higher than, as indicated by their lifestyle or their conduct. If you pursue self-esteem for self-esteem's sake, you end up with self-centeredness. When I worked in the elementary schools and I'd go in and I'd see the bulletin board with the names of the kids on there, I'm special because there's no one else like me. My flower is the prettiest flower in the garden. This relentless, I'm wonderful. And as a consequence, if that attitude was not absorbed, there were those quick to say, something's lacking here in this person's psychological makeup, that they don't see themselves as wonderful and valuable. I had a couple of grandparents come to me once. And their granddaughter, I think she was about 9. They had some kind of Olympics at her school. It was towards the end of the year. And they had a whole bunch of track and field events. One of them was a race. And this little girl didn't finish well in the race at all. She's not fast. But everybody got, I don't know if it was a trophy or a ribbon or an award, everybody that participated in the race got an award. The little girl went to her teacher and said, I really don't want this. I didn't earn it. I'm not a very fast runner. Now, I personally would have hugged that little girl and said, it's wonderful, sweetheart, that you have that kind of balanced self-insight that more or less says your well-being doesn't depend upon how fast you can run. Enough said, end of story, right? No. No. The reason the grandparents called me is because the little girl's teacher contacted them, and I forget whether they were raising her or not, but somehow they were involved in this whole situation, and said, I'm worried about her self-esteem. They asked why. Well, she turned her reward back in as though she didn't deserve it. I don't know if the grandparents said, well, she didn't. And that has nothing to do with who she is. It has nothing to do with how much she's loved. It has nothing to do with her value as a child of God. It has everything to do with the fact that she ran a race and she was 7th out of 10. I love her for that. God bless her for that. That's wonderful. That she has, in fact, a solid enough self-esteem to say, I don't need an artificial pat on the back for everything I try. I wasn't very good at it. If you want to take self-esteem out of the realm of God's declaration and you just use it as a psychological sign of someone's maturity and self-image, then I think strong self-esteem is recognizing your assets and your weaknesses. Christians say things like, I'm a sinner. Ooh, well, that's, wow. That's pretty generic and it's pretty encompassing. It's pretty broad-based. I'm a sinner. Whoa, how can you have any kind of self-esteem calling yourself that? Again, because God says so. God says, you are my child. And despite your sinfulness, if you keep turning to me, that's the kind of self-esteem I want. The whole self-esteem mantra has just gotten, just overwhelmed the cultural landscape. It has become the sine qua non, to use a little Latin lingo, all I remember from my 3 years of Latin, of well-being. For the longest time, so many of the theories were, if we can enhance children's self-esteem, they will be less likely to do things that are short-sighted or hurtful to others or hurtful to themselves or self-destructive. No, as long as they see themselves as just worthy of so much praise and attention, they won't do these things. That has not borne out. That has not been borne out. All that has happened is that we have elevated self-esteem to self-centeredness. I'm wonderful. How dare you think I'm not? So many ideas don't get born out as they pass through the reality of time, and even as they are studied in a more balanced way. All right, coming back, your E-Persons. I'm Dr. Ray. Thank you so much for joining me here on The Doctor Is In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, co-production of the EWTN and Ave Maria Radio Networks. This is from, and I want to give you a warning on this, I want to just mention the Miranda warning here because this is from Miranda. Would you use please and thank you when asking and then / commanding your children to do something? We have 4 kids, 6, 4, 2, 1. Our 6-year-old son has always been a challenge for me, but he's becoming more defiant and disrespectful, eye-rolling, throwing fits, stomping, whimpering, etc. throughout the day. We wonder if he is being harassed by a spirit of defiance for which we are praying the rosary over him and fasting for him. Or how we are mistraining him. I've seen this happen. I have seen parents who are faithfully religious people think that when a kid is recalcitrant, obstreperous, truculent, pugnacious. I do not have a thesaurus in front of me. I looked up those words. That somehow there may be some kind of oppression going on, spiritual oppression. I've never seen it. I have never, ever seen it in my 45 years of clinical practice. The vast majority of the time, 2 factors are at play. 1, the kid by temperament pushes a little bit. He resists a little more than his siblings. That's 1. But the bigger factor, believe it or not, is the parenting. In that, as I've sat and talked with parents, as they've described to me what's going on in their home, the dynamics between them and the child, I find there are many places that they can actually take a much calmer, more firm, authoritative hand over this child, which will result in not only a better behaved child, but a happier child and a happier household. So, they've said, we pray the rosary with him today, and I wondered if our please and thank you makes him feel entitled or something. If we don't use courtesies, he says we're being demanding, and that's not kind. If we try to touch or hold him, he fights us and is suddenly itchy, tired, hurts. Now, let me stop there a couple of places. Before you email me and say, Dr. Ray, this is a sign oftentimes of autistic spectrum disorder, that kind of stimulation really, really bothers kids. I would ask several questions. I would say, 1, are there any other signs? Doesn't sound like there is, from they didn't mention it. 2, does he act that way only in certain contexts? In other words, if the parents are trying to control him and he doesn't want to be touched. And does he act that way with everybody? Or is it just mom and dad who try to discipline him? We've got to narrow that down. If we don't use courtesies, he says we're being demanding and that's not kind. Well, he can think what he wants. He's allowed to think that. He's 6. I wouldn't expect him to understand fully a parent's authority. I mean, it just sounds like he pushes on you. Now, that said, I like using please, and I like using thank you. Please go to the corner. Please go lay on your bed. Please put your head down at the dining room table. I'll set the timer. Then after he gets up, and thank you. In this case, please and thank you is not something that says, will you agree with this? If you think this is something that's appropriate for your contentment, will you cooperate? No, that's not what you're saying. You're just saying please and thank you, but there is no request involved. You have to go to the corner, and I'm saying please simply because I want to use manners. But the corner is non-negotiable. Please does not mean the discipline is negotiable. And thank you doesn't mean, oh, I'm so glad you cooperated. No, it means you cooperated and I appreciate it. Now, saying it's demanding and that's not kind. Okay, say it. So what? I think the parents want him to understand why they do what they do, and he doesn't. He's six. Of course not. I ignore his whines and gently hold him. Okay, there it is. Now, I didn't see that coming because this was an email that I hadn't looked at in a while, which is, that hurts, that itches, stop it. That's his way of saying, don't you dare hold me. And you don't have to hold him. All you have to do is simply say, well, okay, if you're not in the corner, you don't have any privileges until you go to the corner. I mean, that's that simple as it is. Today, he tried to drill his chin into me over and over again. We spank. We have consequences. He's only six. How are we failing here? We are an intact marriage, practicing Catholic home and home school. Well, again, going back to something I said a few minutes ago, It is rare that I talk to parents and we describe the situation, we describe their consequences, we describe their consistency, we describe their perseverance, we describe what consequences they are using, we describe their inability to manipulate it, all of that, and the child doesn't improve. He may not be the easiest of the kids. He could still be tough and he could still push. But the kind of resistance, I can use a personal example. My 10 children are adopted. Some of them have had very difficult womb environments, early life upbringing. In many, many respects, they were bringing with them what one might call baggage. And they did some things that had to be dealt with, of course. Did we have this kind of temper eruption, fit throwing, total oppositional resistance? No, we did not. Why? Because very shortly the kids realized, look, we're going to do what we're going to do, and you're not going to like it. We love you desperately, but we're not going to let you act this way. And the consequences are going to be significant. This is not going to be 3 minutes in the corner. All right, you could lose 9 privileges for an eruption like that. And so we didn't have it. Even though the kids by temperament one would consider tough. Now, my guess would be that this little guy has overwhelmed his parents and they're not sure how to deal with it. What if you have a simple rule? For example, a temper eruption of flow, swing, and all of that stuff automatically leads to 3 days of no privileges. Everything you ask for will be no. You can read, we kiss you, we love you. That's it. You have no privileges. Oh, that would be horrible, Dr. A. You won't have anything to do. He won't have anything to occupy his time. Well, yes and no. I mean, if you want to let him color, you want to pick a few things to keep him occupied, that's fine. But the normal privileges, dessert, outside, whatever toys he has, his stuffed animals, his favorite shirt, all those things, Now, he'll fight that the first few times until he finds out. For your own interest, Dr. Ray, I've been a listener since I was a high schooler, spending hours in the tractor working the ground. I always dreaded the noon hour. Well, this must be coming from the Central Time Zone. But somehow, I listened enough and began looking forward to your show. Now, as a busy mother, I don't often get to listen, but I enjoy and garnish wisdom when I do. Well, thank you, but in closing this, I want to recommend a book to you. It's my most popular discipline book. It's called Discipline That Lasts a Lifetime. It is 100 or more of the most common discipline questions I get asked. I deal with temper tantrums. I deal with disrespect. I deal with sibling quibbling. I deal with bedtime bad times. I deal with meal ordeals. I deal with homework avoidance. I deal with chore shirking. I deal with all kinds of stuff. I deal with the kid comebacks to discipline. I deal with major eruptions. All of that is in the book. All of it. Heavy. Talking about that. Now, some people have said, I got your book. It's still the same. And I'll ask, have you read it? Well, no, not yet. You might want to do that. Not sure how much it's going to do if you just put it under your pillow, lay on the pillow and hope that it osmotically seeps into your head. So I get saddened when I see parents so very frustrated by a six-year-old in situations like that, because almost invariably, if there's nothing wrong with the child, and usually there's not, and it's just a behavior resistance problem, the parents are dramatically underestimating what they need to do to get this under control in terms of consequences and perseverance and predictability. Well, are you better than God?
No way!
Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. E-Person Monday. Let's get to it. Hello. My mother-in-law of nearly 10 years lives about 8 hours away. She has come to visit and see her grandkids one time in, drum roll please, 10 years. Okay, so I'm going to do the math. That indicates that since they got married, she's been there one time. Since marriage, 10 years ago. We cannot visit her due to her renting a very small house. The one time she was here, she basically just wanted us to wait on her hand and foot. She also did not engage with her grandkids. Okay, so that was the tenor of the one visit in 10 years. That ought to tell you something. Now that we are having our third child soon, we welcomed her to come and visit. Now here's a key line. She normally never replies over text, or, you know, and you might say, well, okay, some people that are older don't like texts. They want to talk on the phone, right? She normally never replies over text or answers our call. But when she does, she talks about how bad her experience was. Now, I'm assuming she's alluding to that 1 in 10 year visit, and who knows how long ago that was. And further, how her relationship with us is no good. Yet she refuses to contact us. I think what he's saying is she doesn't want to explore any of this. In her mind, for whatever the reason, she wants no part of her daughter and son-in-law. My wife tries. God bless your wife. Her mother doesn't. Also to mention, Dr. Ray, she doesn't like me, but hasn't said why. Wow, that line doesn't surprise me there. You got somebody coming to visit you one time in 10 years, and the one time they did come, they talk about how bad it was. Well, you can just safely assume there's a whole lot of something going on in her mind about you people. Should we stop trying to reach for her? Should we stop trying to reach her for the kids' sake? In these cases, and I've unfortunately seen a boatload of them, where you have a mother-in-law, mother, father-in-law, father, who doesn't appear at all to like the daughter, son, or in-laws married to them, for whatever the reason. And the younger generation has tried to reach them, has written, has called, has texted, and no response. No response or minimal response of any kind. And punctuated by negativity in the response. At some point, I think it is fair to say, and I think it would not be going against Christian obligation to say something like in a text or a handwritten letter, voicemail, says, we really try to reach you, we love you, but we're going to respect what seems to be your unwillingness to be around us for whatever your reasons. If we're wrong, please let us know that. However, if we do not hear from you, we're going to assume that we are correct and that you don't wish to be part of our lives. We will respect that. We will stop pushing on you to do that if it's something you don't want. I think it's more than fair. It's respectful. It is warm in the sense that you said, hey, we're here. We're open. We want to hear from you. Please contact us. And if she doesn't, she's telling you. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head on that one. I don't want to come around you people. I came once in 10 years and that was too much. How do you explain it to the kids? Well, depending on how old they are, you can explain to them. Now, it sounds like it's probably a young family because they're getting pregnant with their third child, and so probably the kids are no more than 5 or 6, the oldest. You can say that we want to see Grandma, but she can't come here very often. And with little kids, out of sight is out of mind. Little kids are not going to belabor a point if you repeat to them a few times, well, Grandma's just not able to come. You don't have to say, Grandma doesn't want to come. Because little kids, they blame themselves quickly. So until they get old enough to explain to them, we don't understand why Grandma doesn't want to come, but she doesn't. So that's okay. We have our family. We have a good, loving family. And, you know, Dad didn't say anything here about his own side, which probably is somewhat connected. So if you got one good pair of grandparents or one good grandparent, okay, count the blessing. But I think at this point, if you just keep trying and you get rebuffed every time, or you get ignored, the message is pretty clear. Quit bugging me. I don't want to respond to you. And the time that I did come, I clearly didn't want to be there. I didn't interact with the grandkids at all. I didn't want to cooperate in anything around the house. I didn't want to do anything with you. I just came, put my time in until I could go in relief. That's what it sounds like. So the message is pretty clear. Why? I don't know. I have no idea the background of mom and daughter. None. I have no idea the background of mother-in-law because, well, you don't make it sound like there's a father-in-law involved, so whether he passed away or whether they're divorced or whether she's unhappy with life or bitter with life or an individual who is just surly about existence, that's oftentimes the case. And blames others? Who knows? Who knows what the dynamic is? Because she won't tell you. So, at that point, you're sort of having to accept the way it is. You remember the old, wait until your father comes home. You see, that's awful now. That statement that was once a statement of the father's being a recognized authority figure in the household, with love now, would be something that 99.26% of self-anointed experts would say, oh, no, no, that's horrible. That's horrible. That puts father in the position of being the enforcer. That puts mom's authority in question. One could interpret that in good, loving homes as saying, mom and dad are one. And when dad gets home, I'm going to tell him what happened here. I think that's still a very healthy thing in many cases. So, with that in mind as my preface, let's see. Ave Maria! That was the greeting. I got to admit, it's the first time I've ever gotten that as a greeting. My wife and I are struggling with what it looks like for me, the father, to be the head, and he has head in quotes, of disciplining our children. My wife is a homemaker. I work full time. We have 5 kids, ages 7 to 2 months. All right, these are obviously folks that have said, Lord, whatever you want to give us in kids, we are open. 5 kids under 7. Obviously, she does most of the disciplining throughout the day and sees whatever problems there are far more than I do. We talk together about the kids quite often, and I try to be the leader in the house when I'm there. But I'm not there a lot of the time. How can I be the head of my household regarding disciplining my children? Well, that's easy. That is easy. A couple of ways to approach this. First of all, when you are there, you and mom are of one accord. You're one voice. And the kids know that dad is going to back up mom. Even if she is more aware of something that's going awry and you're not, which was the case with me and my wife, she was much more attuned to the happenings of our 10 kids under 12. I said, we have kids? How many? Get out! What's their names? I know most of their names. Don't be asking me their middle names. I tease. Please, please don't email me. Dr. Ray, that's an awful example that you're giving about involved fathers. So that said, you can certainly be of one accord, and the kids can know that dad is the one who is going to enforce the discipline, whether it's done by dad or by mom, when you're there. Now, the fact that you're not there, it doesn't mean you're not the head of the discipline, because mom does discipline. That's great. You got a wife that can handle that, do that. Man, That was one of the things I just loved my wife for, because when I came home, she homeschooled. When I came home and the kids had pulled whatever scrap they had pulled, she handled it. She took care of it. But here's the difference. Here is the difference. And I think this is how you can be a more involved dad in this discipline arena. The kids knew that my wife was going to tell me what they did if it was particularly noteworthy. If it was a tiny little scrap, she took care of it. But if it was something that was out of the ordinary in its significance of misbehavior, she's going to tell me. And then, depending on what she did, I added to it. Now, that said, if I came home, I asked my wife, honey, how'd the day go? And she told me, well, here's what John did. And she listed a litany of his uncooperativeness or whatever it might have been at that time. I said, did you handle it? She goes, yeah, I handled it. I took John aside. I said, Johnny, Mom tells me you were really pretty uncooperative, son.
Oh, no.
Well, I gotta go with what Mom says. So, here's what Dad's going to do. Because, yeah, you were uncooperative with Mom, but also, she didn't need to have her day made difficult more than once. So here's what I want you to do. So they knew they were going to answer to Dad, even if Mom disciplined them. Now, if she said to me, I took care of it, Ray, no problem, I say, okay, good. Problem solved. Check it off the list. But if she said to me, well, he did this when I tried to get him in the corner. Oh, really? Really? James, when your mom told you to go to the corner, you didn't go? You had to be threatened to go? What? Oh, James, my son, I sure wish you would have gone to the corner and simply just quietly done your corner time. Oh, gosh, son, I don't want to hear that. Well, here's what I'm going to do. You're going to bed early tonight, and tomorrow you're not allowed outside. Whatever. That's just an example. Whatever it was that I could think of on the spur of the moment. And if I couldn't think of anything on the spur of the moment, I took a few minutes to think of something. Or I asked Randy. I said, honey, what would you like me to do about this? So really, Dad, that's the way you can become involved. If they know that even though Mom handled it, she's going to talk to you about it. And between the two of you, if you decide this also involves Dad's response, I think that's a great way to show the kids you are one. I used to say, Mom and I are two fingers joined together. You rattle one, the other one rattles. And they knew that. They knew that it was not going to go unspoken if my wife said to me, I think Dad needs to know about this. Sure, it's not a matter that I was the enforcer. I came home and kicked the door in and said, all right, I'm back. Who do I have to handle? It wasn't like that at all. Matter of fact, it was more of a quiet sit-down. Son, why don't you tell me what you did?
Well, I didn't listen to Mom.
Well, what didn't you listen?
Well, she told me to come in, and I just stayed out there.
Well, how'd she get you in?
Well, she said she was going to give me extra work if I wasn't in the next 20 seconds.
Oh. So you made Mom discipline you to get you in the house. You just didn't come in because she asked you?
I guess not.
Oh, all right. Well, son, I think you need to do what your mom tells you without her having to threaten to discipline you. So now I'm going to do something about it.
Well, Mom already did.
Yeah, I know. I know she did. But see, that's how me and Mom work. We go together. And I didn't want Mom having to have a tough time when she didn't need to. That's all. Dad, you can do that. And you'll be very much an active, authoritative figure right beside your wife. I'm Dr. Ray. One here. Clinically speaking, are worry and anxiety the same thing? No, but they're cousins. There is a certain expression of anxiety called generalized anxiety. That means there is an interfering level of distress, emotional upheaval, that is fueled by worry. And most of these worries come in the form of what ifs. Well, what if is a speculation on something that could happen that, however unlikely it is to happen, still creates distress because, well, it could happen. For example, a newly pregnant mom, mixed in with her excitement about being pregnant is a worry. What if the baby isn't healthy? What if the baby has complications? What if I don't carry the baby to term? So the what ifs are beginning to grab hold of her mood and create anxiety. Now, it is possible that there could be complications or the baby couldn't be healthy. That's true. That does happen. But fortunately, in the modern era that we consider ourselves living in, that's much, much less likely than it used to be. It used to be 50%. Now it's nowhere near that high. Most kids, I'd say 95%, are born rather uneventfully, especially if mom takes care of herself when the baby's in the womb. But the what if is nagging, and the what if creates anxiety. Or you start a new job. What if I can't handle it? What if I run up against a very difficult boss? What if I find that this isn't really something that I've wanted to do after 3 months? There's no limit to the what ifs you can create. As imaginative as you can be, what ifs can be multiplied. And the characteristics of a what if is, one, generally unlikely, sometimes highly unlikely, remotely unlikely. That's one. Two, you dwell on it. You give it a life that is far beyond anything it deserves. And three, and here's a big one, if it were to happen, I just couldn't deal with it. Going back to our baby, if a parent has a handicapped child, or maybe a child with Down syndrome, or a child with developmental delays, what they were worried about, the what if, the small percentage what if, happened. It is not unusual for the parents to say, this has become an unexpected blessing. This child is at the very center of our lives. This child with Down syndrome is so warm and so loving, so beautiful in her demeanor. She is the center of our family. So a what if oftentimes is accompanied by, if it were to happen, I couldn't deal with it. But once you tell yourself, for the most part, my what if can be dealt with, if I can't handle the job, and I decide to quit. Okay, now what? You're going to look for another job? Sure. It isn't, to use a cliche, the end of the world because you left a job. May turn out to be a blessing because 2 months down the road you get a job that you absolutely love. So yes, worry creates anxiety, and much worry is not based in probable reality. It is worry that is concocted in our head and dwelt upon and becomes larger than life, and pretty soon isn't a what if, it's going to happen. And once that takes over, anxiety ratchets up very, very high. Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor's Inn. I appreciate it so very much. Andrew Krucek for keeping me company over there in Ann Arbor, my producer man, and he mans the boards, to use a little basketball lingo. Good Lord permitting, plan to see you tomorrow when we can talk together. On The Doctor's Inn, walk with God. Don't make that one a what if.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRRay.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.